Yes to Life Show. I'm Robin Daly, and the Yes to Life Show is all about integrative medicine for cancer, a fast emerging field that includes both conventional and complementary approaches. Today, I'm speaking to medical herbalist Claudia Manchanda, and specifically looking into the many ways that herbal medicine can be used alongside conventional cancer treatments. I'm talking to Claudia at her home over Skype. Claudia, thank you very much indeed for coming on the show. Very interested to talk to you about herbal medicine and conventional cancer treatments.
Hiya, Robin.
So lots of people facing a cancer diagnosis are interested in all sorts of complementary approaches these days, but they're also often warned off them by oncologists. And herbal medicine, your specialism, is often singled out as notably problematic and a risk in terms of potential undesirable interactions. So I'm really wanting to know, how much substance would you say there is in these claims, and what's your experience of the place of herbal medicine alongside conventional treatments?
Okay, so firstly I would say there definitely is substance, because herbs are complex pharmacologically active agents and they're often referred to as plant drugs, but there's many of them in one product. And therefore there's a lot of potential for herb-drug interactions, or even herb-herb interactions with the drugs, and even food interactions. However, regardless of this, there's still a huge amount of scope for safe adjuvant herbal support alongside mainstream treatments, and I think there's a potential for a lot of integration too. As my experience as a very cautious herbalist, herbs help enormously alongside orthodox treatment. For example, I've worked with patients who've had recurrent pneumonia when they've had treatment for, let's say, Hodgkin's lymphoma, and just simple things like garlic juice and fresh thyme tincture have made the difference between them not getting repeated infections. Herbs often improve mood, side effects. But then sort of going into what interactions there can be, a classic famous plant is St. John's wort, Hypericum perforatum, is an example of a wonderful antidepressant, antiviral herb, but it speeds up the metabolism of an enzyme system in the body called the P45 cytokine enzyme. There's a particular pathway called CYP3A4, which is an enzyme involved in the oxidative metabolism of about 50% of prescription medications, and also estrogen, for example. So Hypericum speeds that up, which means that the half-life of a drug is increased, and basically the drugs leave the body much faster. So for people that are dependent on certain medications like anti-HIV, protease inhibitors, or warfarin, or even antidepressants, it can speed up the clearance. But because St. John's wort also interacts with many neurotransmitters, such as serotonin 5-HT receptors, GABA, and monoamine oxidase receptors, it's contraindicated with many antidepressants, because a patient could get something called serotonin syndrome. And also, Hypericum would speed up the metabolism of chemotherapy, for example. I mean, this actually can be used when people aren't on medications. It can be used as a therapeutic plus, because it can speed up detoxification. But if people are on medications, a herbalist will be very cautious using certain drugs which speed up those pathways. And then conversely, there are products like grapefruit and citricidal, which are used often as antibacterial remedies, but they have the opposite, and they lengthen the half-life of a drug, so they keep a drug in the body longer. But they work by doing this by speeding up the degradation of a different enzyme. And basically, people on drugs like antiepileptics, warfarin, digoxin, the toxic dose of those drugs can then be increased, because if people's metabolism is slowing down and they're taking more drug, it means that the serum presence of the drug is increased. if that makes sense.
It does.
Then another thing I just wanted to add is that herbs can actually improve mainstream treatment too. So berberine-containing plants like barberry, golden seal, golden thread all increase the penetration of chemotherapy drugs through the blood-brain barrier. So they can be used for, let's say, intracranial tumours. And they've been used for improving the outcomes for basal cell carcinoma and pre-cancerous conditions like actinic keratosis. Herbal products like resveratrol makes Herceptin more effective. There's also an extract from the plant called pawpaw, and that actually stops cancer cells spewing out the chemo, so they actually uptake the chemo. So I mean, there is so much to consider when it comes to how herbs can work, but I mean, just sort of generally speaking, the most impressive way they work is helping with side effects while people are on therapy, and then you can look for sort of looking at the whole therapeutic strategy when people are not on chemotherapy, for example. But there are many immunomodulating herbs that work side by side, chemotherapy and radiotherapy. And obviously, while people are on treatment, a herbalist is a lot more cautious and aware of drug-herb interactions. But I think it's really important to stress that herbs have nutritive effects, which synthetic drugs just lack. So a herb may be hepatoprotective, it may be antineoplastic, it may be immunomodulatory, it may be adaptogenic, it may be anxiolytic, as well as having a lot of other effects as well.
So basically you're selling the idea that there's actually an awful lot that herbal medicine has to offer in lots of different ways,
definitely,
but
definitely.
With caution. There are definitely reasons to not be too gung-ho about it. You just referred to several different modes of action that herbs can have, many of them simultaneously. They're all quite technical terms. Do you want to just explain a little bit about what each one means?
Yes, of course. So when I say a herb is hepatoprotective, that means it protects the cells of the liver. When people are taking drugs, and there are some chemotherapies that specifically damage the liver, like cyclophosphamide, for example, this can actually prevent the damage that's occurring. And the herbs can also have other effects. Some herbs that may be what I've just said, hepatoprotective, may also be a term called antineoplastic. That means that they actually stop cell proliferation, or they might even stop DNA damage within a cell. I also said that herbs may be immunomodulating, and that means that they stimulate aspects of the immune system that might be deficient and may slow down aspects of the immune system that may be causing something like inflammation. So it's really interesting because some of the herbs and mushrooms affect the immune system in ways that are unique to each individual, and they have a way of balancing out what's needed. And it's not often fully understood how they do it. But I mean, they know that polysaccharides in mushrooms interact with certain parts of the immunity, but they seem to have it's called immunomodulating because it actually balances it out for each individual. So it's also called a host-mediated response. I'm sorry for all the technical terms.
No, well, that's how it is. That's the territory we're in. But it's good,
yes.
Good to go into them a little bit and just see what they mean. I mean,
yeah, I'm happy to do that. And I'm happy to, you know, anything that I'm not clear on, please do ask.
So it's a unique property that natural products have. This one where really, this is a big difference between natural products and conventional drugs, is that drugs always have the same mode of operation, but the same effect, should I say. But these type of natural products can actually stimulate a process in one person and damp it down in another as appropriate.
Yes, most definitely. That is a phenomenon that is definitely seen. I mean, it's almost common sense because we have evolved with plants, but we haven't evolved with pharmaceutical drugs.
Yeah.
So our bodies know inherently what to do with them. So, you know, for thousands of years we have lived eating plants, having plants for our survival, and mushrooms, and our bodies definitely know what to do with them.
Mm.
Plants are whole products. So there's a saying in herbal medicine that the whole is greater than the sum of the parts.
Right.
So that refers to all of the different chemicals within a plant having synergistic effects with each other. Some may potentiate each other, and some of them may actually mitigate side effects. And then when a herbalist is actually making a prescription, they'll actually use herbs to do the same. So you might use many different herbs in one remedy to potentiate one herb or to actually mitigate toxic effects of other herbs.
Well, it's a fascinating area and certainly one to be aware of, because of these unique benefits. Okay, so look, could you maybe tell us a little bit about yourself? So I'd like to know how and why you came to herbal medicine at all and the ways you've worked with it. And I think you have your own health journey that, if you don't mind, I'd like to ask you about that as well.
Yeah, of course. I started being interested in herbal medicine about 20 years ago, and I've been working as a chef and cooking in health food shops, and I wanted to broaden my horizons academically, but I also wanted to sort of work out what I'd wanted to do long-term as a career. And I did several evening classes, and I did an amazing evening class with a herbalist called Nina Nissen, and I also had sort of purchased a book by Nicholas Culpepper, who is a 17th century physician. It was written over 300 years ago, and I became fascinated with the science and the art of traditions of herbal medicine. Then also, I think, when I grew up as a child, my father was a homeopath, and I developed a good memory for the remedies, the materia medica in homeopathy, and I got to grips from a very young age the notion of constitutions of both remedies and constitutions of characters and humans. And also I was surrounded by a lot of illness. There was diabetes in my family and lots of kind of digestive health issues. And I was always interested from a very young age in how can some people be well and some people are ill, and how does lifestyle affect that? So after qualifying as a herbalist in about 2000, I spent several years in the world of academia. I didn't actually go straight on to being a herbalist at all. And I was teaching sort of many courses like access to medicine, pathology, materia medica of herbs, pharmacology, like bog standard pharmacology, not just plant pharmacology, hence all my technical language that I use today. And then after that, I became a manager in a health charity running community cooking courses for specific groups with eating disorders or people with type 2 diabetes, people living with mental illness, and how foods can actually improve your health, and also to improve cooking skills of communities, because people are so into eating ready meals. And there's a huge sort of takeaway culture where people, especially people who have not got a lot of money, it's cheaper to eat takeaway foods.
Ridiculous, isn't it?
Yes. And then while I was doing that job, I returned from a trip to Sudan for work, and I was feeling very depleted and quite sort of run down. I'd had quite a stressful year in my job and in my personal life, and I lost a lot of weight. And, I'd been away for, a few weeks. And I woke up one morning, and I rolled over, and I thought I'd rolled onto a Lego brick or something. So I went out to reach it because it felt uncomfortable, and then I realised that this hard lump, this brick-like thing, was actually in my body, and it was in my breast. And my heart sank. I couldn't actually believe what I was feeling. I was feeling this hard lump. So I sort of immediately had a sense of doom. I knew it was something quite serious, and it was a Sunday. I remember it vividly. And so the next day, I went straight away to my GP. I wouldn't sort of even wait for an appointment. I insisted on being seen. And they gave me a referral to UCLH, One Stop Breast Clinic, it's called.
Yeah.
And about 10 days later, I went and had this mass drained. And it was it got so big so quickly because it had developed a cyst around it. So I had it drained, and I was told then, practically then and there, that I had breast cancer and that my breast would have to go, with the words that the doctor said. And then I had a biopsy that day. And then 10 days later, I was told I had invasive ductal carcinoma. And about 6 weeks later, I had a mastectomy. And they'd actually offered me chemo and to have a lumpectomy. But I pushed for the mastectomy because I really didn't want to have chemotherapy by any means necessary. Mm-hmm. So after I had the mastectomy, it was found in my lymph nodes. And then I had to make a sort of risk-benefit assessment on, do I risk it and not have chemo, or do I have chemo? And my oncologist sort of twisted my arm, and I sort of had got into such a tizz that I decided I had to have chemo because I felt like I didn't have control. That's how I felt at the time then.
Mm-hmm.
So after that, I had about 6 months of chemo, and maybe 7 months of chemo, actually, because I had huge breaks within the chemo because I had such dire side effects to the chemo, like quite unusual ones. So, you know, I had a PICC line fitted, and it gave me a meter-long deep vein thrombosis. So then I had to have anticoagulants for 9 months. I had several episodes of neutropenia, and I was put into isolation a few times.
Neutropenia, so would you chemo... just explain, people?
Oh, so neutropenia is when you have... there's a certain type of white blood cell that you need in immunity. I didn't have any neutrophils at all.
Right. So very low immune system.
A very, very, very low immunity. So, I mean, I've learned a lot from then as a practitioner. I mean, this whole experience has taught me I can honestly say that cancer's been my biggest apprenticeship as a human being,
right.
and as a herbalist, a scientist, and on every level. You know, I learned so much about the patient's experience, about the cancer patient's experience, about losing control, losing identity, losing body parts, about actually facing death at quite a young age, and also witnessing what other people had to go through, and also connecting with other people with cancer and how important that is, and also, alas, having to lose people along the way. I mean, it's a humbling experience, and it's such a loaded subject, but you learn so much along the way. And I've learned so much about herbal medicine from other people with cancer.
Mm. Can we come back now to some of the areas in which herbal medicine could help as part of an integrative program of cancer treatment? So, you know, just like to go through it step by step if we can. Now, you already mentioned that one of the most dramatic areas where it can quite obviously help is with side effects of conventional treatment.
Yes.
These, of course, are some of the greatest issues that people have to deal with. And some of them are actually being managed fairly well conventionally, but others are a huge issue for people. I mean, low energy and chemo brain are two things that, like, so many people complain of, and they're not just annoying, these are completely debilitating. And then there are things like there's lymphedema, there's gut inflammation, peripheral neuropathy, where people are getting damage to nerves and their fingers and... So, you know, these are serious issues.
Yeah,
and
so would you like me to go through some of them?
Yeah, come on, let's hear what you've got.
Yeah, sure. Well, for low energy, I mean, another thing I just want to say before I go into specific herbs, and I won't go too much into so many herbs, because herbal medicines are very much an individualised treatment for the person. But what I wanted to say is that herbalists are also qualified in nutrition. They have like 4 years training.
Right.
So a diet would be a huge aspect of a herbalist treatment. So again, looking at individuals and what they need, and also what their constitution and what their signs and symptoms are, I would definitely look at nutrition first.
Right.
And because there's a huge crossover with herbs and food, from almost all of the symptoms you'll talk about, there are three categories of herbs, and they're called adaptogens. So they include things like medicinal mushrooms. They include a herb called astragalus. In Chinese, it's called huanqi. There's also the ginsengs, like Siberian ginseng and Panax ginseng, are things that would be generic adjuvant treatments, the side effects, just generically, because they help with things like chemo brain, they help with low energy, and they're on the cusp. I mean, especially the medicinal mushrooms and the astragalus are on the cusp of being foods. And nutrition is such a huge part of helping somebody, supporting somebody with cancer, because they're generally very depleted and almost malnourished at the time that they're presenting with cancer. So, you know, there's a lot of talk about things like detoxification and cleansing, but the first thing you have to do is nourish. And when you're sort of being literally like there's sort of a chemical warfare going on in your body, nourishment is key. So I would definitely say astragalus and medicinal mushrooms. Medicinal mushrooms is a huge category, and there's about 280 therapeutic mushrooms. But there are specific ones like Ganoderma lucidum, which is called reishi, which is just the most incredible mushroom. There's also a herb called Gotukola, Centella asiatica, which again is another herbal adaptogen. It helps the body to withstand stress. This one might be used if someone's suffering from a lot of anxiety. As, you know, I said to you earlier about how herbs have many effects. Hmm. How a herbalist chooses the herb for a person will be how they're presenting. So rather than using Siberian ginseng, if someone's got enormous anxiety, I might use Gotukola. For symptoms like chemo brain, there are so many herbs. There can be some invigorating herbs that actually improve cerebral circulation, so that's circulation to the brain. And that's herbs like ginkgo biloba or rosemary, Rosmarinus officinalis. And these herbs also, in a herbal remedy, might be called a vehicle. So sometimes, because they open the blood vessels to the brain, they can actually carry other herbs with them.
Right.
So, you know, before when I was talking about a balance of a prescription. Mm-hmm. There are things like for chemo brain, you need to nourish the nerves. So traditional herbs for nourishing the nerves a herb I mentioned earlier is Hypericum perforatum, but that might have drug interactions. So you could also choose oat straw. The actual straw of oats, they're a traditional remedy for bathing the nerves. Mm. I would also look at vitamins, essential fatty acids, and omega-3s. Curcumin is quite a sort of famous remedy for people with cancer. It might be something that I'd consider to stop inflammation in the brain, or it might be a herb that I wouldn't use as well because it's very constitutional-based. I mean, what makes herbal medicine wonderful is that you can actually choose herbs specifically, and what I've discovered over the last couple of years, that it actually links with genetic presentation that people have. There's tests that people can have. They're called genetic polymorphisms that show how their gene expression affects the way they metabolize foods and herbs. And so far what I've discovered is it fits with constitutional theories in herbal medicine. I know that sounds kind of vague, but basically in herbal medicine, people are seen to have constitutions, mm-hmm. and they may have a mixture of different ones. And even the organs have like a way of expressing themselves physically, and that affects the way you choose a remedy. I mentioned a herb before called Gotukola, Centella asiatica, and this is one that, like I said, it's an adaptogen and it's a nerve tonic, but it also speeds up healing, and it's called a herb that makes you heal without a scar. And that's one that I might consider using before and after someone's had surgery to reduce scarring, or I might use that alongside arnica and daisy, the common plant daisy, Bellis perennis, to stop bruising. Another side effect that people can be high platelets or low platelets. So there's the herb that I mentioned. The herbs that you can use alongside mainstream medicine come up again and again, and astragalus, the one, it balances out blood cells. So you'd use that for high or low platelets. Siberian ginseng, again, you could use for low platelets or high platelets. Echinacea, which is sort of commonly used in the West for immunomodulation, also raises red blood cells too. There are other herbs that you could use. Now, this is a bit more complex, and people need to see a herbalist, but there are also herbs that are very strong anticoagulants. So they include feverfew and garlic, reishi is another one. Some soya phytoestrogens are anticoagulant, and so is turkey tail mushrooms. So if someone's on anticoagulant medication, you might not want to give it to them. But if somebody is prone to getting clots, it's something they could take as a maintenance. Mm. There's other herbs. Herbs have a chemical in them called tannins. And tannins bind, they precipitate membranes. And tannins is what is used to make leather hard. And tannins are very useful for topical applications to ulcers. So if someone has mouth ulcers from chemo or generally just suffers from mouth ulcers, there are herbs that you can use that contain a very, very rich in tannin. So an example is myrrh. Another is green tea. But they're very useful for sort of sealing the mucous membranes. And also when people have diarrhea from chemo, you can use herbs that either soothe the gut or seal the mucous membranes as well. Mm. There's also herbs, I mean, I could go on and on about side effects.
Amazing. Now, I mean, that's a huge arsenal of approaches already, multiple approaches to the same problem even. Yep. So that's pretty fantastic. So I think it's quite clear that herbal medicine is going to help you with your side effects. Maybe we could look now a bit more at the serious kind of long-term damage that is, you know, it's part and parcel of having treatments like chemotherapy and radiotherapy. And also, importantly, the risk of recurrence, which, of course, is not something that orthodox medicine is very good at helping with. They tend to tell you to go away and keep your fingers crossed and hope it's not going to come back.
Yeah.
So maybe those two areas, has herbalism got anything to offer there?
Yes, and again, it sort of goes with the cusp of food and maintenance. And I think to answer the questions about preventing recurrence and general cancer prevention, the answers are almost the same always. So, I mean, you know, generally the most important thing is to eat healthily and try to eat foods that are not contaminated with pesticides, because pesticides are tumour promoters. It's what I used to even teach. When I used to work in the job in the charity, I used to work with like 5-year-olds and 3-year-olds, and I used to teach them to eat a rainbow from a very, very young age. And that means that, you know, the foods on your plate should have an array of colours, and each one of those colours have different amazing phytonutrients. So sort of red and orange colours have chemicals called carotenoids, and the purple colours have chemicals called anthocyanins, which inhibit cancer cell development. They inhibit metastases, and they help oxygenation in the body. I think even though I'm meant to be talking about herbs, I think oxygenation, exercise, and having a sense of peace are key for health for everybody. Herbally, if I want to look at oxygenation, there might be herbs I could use, like ginkgo biloba or rhodiola rosea, and they basically dilate blood vessels and increase oxygen carrying capacity of the blood, and they've been studied. Drinking juices like green juices, they're rich of chlorophyll, and that helps with oxygen uptake around the body. Eating loads of green vegetables. I mean, herbs are akin to diet when it comes to maintenance of the health. So there are lots of things one can do, like eating with the seasons, having more raw foods in the summer, enzymes. And when someone's ill, you can use herbs to actually help you through a flu, or use garlic and thyme instead of antibiotics. In the springtime, traditionally, people in this country drank things called springtime tonics. They've got cleavers, nettles, and dandelions, and they basically are full of potassium and magnesium, and they also stimulate detoxification. Eating bitter foods is very important. So things like chicory and bitter leaves that you get in salads are very, very important, because when you eat something bitter, it stimulates the taste buds in the back of your mouth, and it's called the bitter reflex, and it actually stimulates your nervous system and your hormonal system, and that makes a huge cascade of reactions, like your pancreas releases pancreatin, and your liver produces bile and spills it into the bile duct, and your whole sort of digestive activity improves, so you digest food better. And traditionally, bitter herbs are often used for anemia, and for some reason, even just having low-dose bitter herbs stimulates hemopoiesis, which means the formation of blood. So, yeah, I would say sort of for prevention long-term, it's about sort of living a healthy lifestyle, and many of the bright-coloured foods basically stop your blood from being sticky and your vessels from being sticky, and it can actually sort of prevent metastases in the future if you've got circulating tumour cells. A lot of the bright coloured foods, highly pigmented foods, also protect our cells from DNA damage, And that's very, very important for people who've already had cancer, because after cancer, you can have circulating stem cells. And for them to actually make new tumours, they have to mutate further. Mm-hmm. So diet, stress alleviation and exercise are all things that are very key for people not wanting to have recurrence and for people who are trying to protect themselves.
Mm, which should be anyone with any sense. Okay, yes, that exactly. Sounds great. And can we get a bit specific? Say, some of the chemotherapies are well known for damaging heart muscle and things like that. Is there anything in herbal medicine that can help with that type of problem?
Yes. Oh, most definitely. There's a herb that's very important for the heart, and it's called hawthorn. And traditionally, the leaf and the berry are taken together. Mm-hmm. And it's protective for heart muscle. And there are specific drugs like Herceptin, which is known to sort of damage heart valves and heart muscle. And that is one of the herbs that I would use quite safely alongside Herceptin, for example.
All right. Great. So the strategy is there. All right. And so we haven't really talked about surgery so much. Do you have things to help with surgery both before and after?
Yes. I mean, one of the herbs that I mentioned was Gotu Kola, and that helps healing generically, and it helps with scar tissues. There are also mixes that a herbalist can make up before and after surgery to help with healing. And then, again, there are mixes that there are adaptogenic herbs that I've mentioned before, like the ginsengs and the astragalus, that people can take to strengthen their resistance throughout the whole process, and there won't be many interactions with any of the mainstream drugs. There are herbs that as a herbalist post surgery, I would be inclined to give herbs after the surgery, so it doesn't actually interfere with the actual surgical process while somebody is actually under anaesthetic, in case it interacts with any of the anaesthetic drugs, and also because of coagulation issues, I would be very cautious giving herbal medicine doses during that period. But before and after, yes, definitely, there would be a lot of scope for herbal support. But again, like I said, there has to be a lot of caution.
Mm. Okay, and you've already said quite a bit about immune suppression that goes hand in hand, of course, with conventional treatment. But there are amazing things like the medicinal mushrooms, which can help enormously with this, I know, which you've mentioned already.
Yeah.
So that's another great area to look at. Okay, so all the discussion we've had so far has been about people who've been diagnosed with cancer, have had cancer in some way, or are in the midst of treatment. Just say people are feeling they're at risk of cancer, which, I mean, everybody should feel that, with one in two of us destined to be diagnosed at this point. Has herbal medicine got anything on offer which is preventative generally for healthy, in inverted commas, healthy people?
What somebody who's had cancer wants to do for prevention is the same what any of us would do.
Okay.
But I can go into some specifics. So, like I said earlier, eating a rainbow, eating all of the different coloured foods, eating yellow, pink, blue, purple, white, black foods that are naturally that colour, is really, really useful for sort of nourishing your body. Strengthening the immunity with vitamin C-containing foods and zinc. Herbs like echinacea and medicinal mushrooms can be taken for people who are not sick because they're nutritive.
Okay.
Eating bitter foods regularly, not eating refined foods, avoiding pesticides and chemicals. I mean, brassicas vegetables are very significant for cancer prevention. Tea, green tea and white tea block tumour promotion. Onions contain chemicals called sulfurs that prevent tumour formation and actually accelerate the detoxification of carcinogens. Eating legumes is important. And also doing regular detoxification, so sort of having periods where you're limiting toxins in your body and having tonics to actually speed up your metabolism and detoxify. And some people, I don't think many people would be into this, like fasting occasionally is actually, very good for rebooting the immune system.
Okay, yeah. Great. That's very helpful. Thank you. Okay, so I suppose it goes without saying that for somebody who's not doing conventional treatment for whatever reason, either because there's nothing on offer or yeah. because they choose to go another path, herbal medicine is obviously a kind of go-to for those people.
Yes, perhaps. I mean, I was thinking about this earlier, and I was thinking, you know, it's quite sort of erroneous ground, this whole subject. So, firstly, because of the 1939 Cancer Act, it's a criminal act for herbalists to treat cancer or say that they're treating cancer. And
true.
Any self-respecting herbalist actually wouldn't say that, and they'd say they're treating the person because that is what we do.
Right.
But it's also made it very difficult for herbalists to actually learn about the traditions of healing cancer, because cancer is only covered for 4 hours of a 4-year degree. Because of the Cancer Act. Having said that, in clinical training, we can see cancer patients all the time, and it's a holistic approach. But I think because of the Cancer Act, and because training isn't geared specifically towards cancer, it's made an underground scene where people are human guinea pigs and people are trying herbs in different ways. And I'll confess that I've tried herbs in ways that I've not always been sure of as a herbalist.
All right.
I mean, a classic example is black salving, which is quite a traditional treatment for cancer.
Mm-hmm.
And I've seen amazing success cases, and I've also seen what I can call quite horrific stories.
Right.
So I think people have to be very, very careful. But there's a huge scope for unconventional herbal treatment as well. I mean, I think when a herbalist witnesses it the most is when basically someone has a stage 4 cancer and they're disillusioned with the mainstream treatment because the cancer has come back. And then people go all out with taking herbs. And I have seen people time and time again get better, but I've equally seen people where it hasn't worked. So I want to be very clear on that.
Right.
Yes. I mean, I was reading the other day in an Ayurvedic journal that there are 1,000 plant chemicals that possess significant anti-cancer properties. And it was also saying that there were 25,000 plants that are shown to kill cancer cells through various mechanisms. So, I mean, what I would say to answer the question is that I think herbal medicine has a rich and important place within an integrated program, which includes diet, stress relief, and many other things. I think it has a huge place. I mean, just to get a tiny bit technical, which I'll try and explain, there are chemicals. There's a plant called Boswellia serrata. It's mm-hmm. also known as Indian ginseng. There are chemicals in curcumin, in turmeric called curcumin, and there are chemicals in green tea and white tea that are inducers of cell death. The correct term is apoptosis. Curcumin also inhibits enzymes and tumor promoter chemicals like protein tyrosine kinase and nuclear factor kappa B. There's a chemical in chamomile and parsley and celery called apigenin, and that inhibits invasion enzymes. So there are many ways for a balanced diet and herbal medicine that cancer can be approached.
Mm.
It's not a magic bullet.
Important to make that
yeah.
point. Few things are.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So this yeah. year, Yes to Life, we're picking up on a great phrase from Tom Meadmore's coming documentary, The Cancer Conflict, which is starting the conversation. I think you were at a recent talk that I gave to nutritionists and naturopaths on this subject, so you'll know that Yes to Life's heading up an initiative to get mainstream medics to start talking to complementary practitioners as a way to begin to break down
yeah.
the barriers, the mistrust and the lack of mutual understanding,
yeah.
which has existed for far too long. This is the only way we stand
yeah.
any hope of moving the agenda for integration forward. So I just wanted to ask whether you've had any positive experiences of collaborating with conventional doctors in any way, and what your thoughts are about helping with this desperately needed change.
Oh, alas, I haven't. I really haven't. I mean, the only times I think I've ever had positive responses are from medics who are already herbalists, because quite a few medics are actually herbalists. They've
right.
qualified after becoming medics. But from my own experience, it's been pretty grim. I really wish there could be a lot more integration, and I wish that the doctors would recognise medical herbalists as qualified professionals and scientists and not eccentric oddbods.
Right.
Recently, I was talking to a gynaecologist about raspberry leaf tea and vaginal douches of a plant called Thuja, and how pessaries can be used for human papillomavirus infection, which is linked to cervical cancer. And she looked at me like I was completely batty. And then she said to me, be careful what you read on the internet. And I just didn't even have the energy to say I'm a medical herbalist, because I didn't feel like I would be taken seriously. Mm. I think it needs to change a lot. But I think, you know, I think that the fact that blancmange and jelly are served as suggested foods to chemo patients is a metaphor for the current state of the NHS and the health system. Because it's sort of, if you look at other countries like China, it's not considered subversive to use herbal blends with chemotherapy. And there are, you know, there are several clinics around the world where natural therapies are used to mitigate or potentiate chemo, for example. So I think there's a huge need. And also I think sort of a lot of doctors potentiate a lot of fear about herbal remedies. I remember when I was having chemo and I had really sort of quite profound flushes, and I couldn't sleep at night. I was having hot flushes every night, and I was telling my surgeon about it. And she said, you know, you could try sage for that, but whatever you do, don't have any phytoestrogens. And I said to her, well, sage is full of phytoestrogens, and so are carrots, and so are onions, and so are apples. And she just looked completely sort of shocked when I said that. Hmm. And I told her I was a herbalist. Yeah, so I think there's a lot of ways that integration could be useful for a patient-centred approach to oncology. And again, like I said earlier, there are studies that show that like pawpaw extract helps drug-resistant cancer that spews out chemotherapy to actually take the drug. So even from an oncological perspective, herbal medicines can be really useful. I also think listening to patients is really key for an integrative approach, and it's something that needs to be incorporated into oncology generally, because there's so much to learn from patients themselves.
Right. Well, this is all, of course, as government policy has been for years, patient-centred care that you mentioned, a patient choice, have been government policy for a very long time. They just have been a while actually appearing on the wards. But anyway, we're hell-bent on trying to promote a conversation, because it's only when these people start talking to each other that they realise you're not a batty woman, that you actually are a highly trained professional, and you know a lot about your subject.
Yes.
And you have a lot to offer.
Yeah, well, I'd be happy to collaborate in anything that you're doing with that, because it's something I'm very passionate about, and I really do believe there's a huge role for herbal medicine as adjuvant treatment, and for treatment at times where people are sort of at a loss with their treatment and they need support with different directions. There's a huge place for herbal medicine.
Mm. Okay, well, look, we're nearly out of time. I just want to ask you as a last question.
Okay.
I'd like to come back to you and your own health and ask, out of all the approaches you've used to help yourself, how important a role has herbal medicine played, and what do you think has been its greatest strength in helping you?
That's actually quite a difficult question, because when I got diagnosed with cancer, initially I went into stasis, and I'll just be totally honest, I didn't take anything. I did eat well, but I didn't even take herbs. I was in such a shock, and it took me quite a long time to actually get my ass into gear and start looking at how to treat myself. Because though, even though I'm a herbalist, I am a terrible patient, an absolutely awful patient. But I got there. I did get there. I mean, I was in so much shock when I was first diagnosed. I just didn't even look objectively at anything. But so to say how herbal medicine has helped me, let me think about it. I think on a very sort of generic level, herbal medicine's like it's a deep phenomenon for me. It connects me to the earth, it connects me to the ground, it connects me to my body and my sense of healing. it connects me to my ancestors and my DNA. I love going on herbal walks. I love seeing plants that are growing. And in herbal medicine, there's a saying, local herbs for local people. Mm. And that recognises that the plants you need are on your doorstep, like seasonal vegetables are. Mm. And so you can actually have a look at what you need at that time of year in the area that's surrounding you. Even when you live in the city, all, you know, there are lots of cytotoxic, so cancer-killing herbs, even growing in the cracks of the pavement. Like the other day, I saw a herb called Chelidonium majalis, which is made into a chemotherapy in the Ukraine, and it's used traditionally for liver cancer. Just after I got diagnosed, there was one herb that I did have regularly. It was called Virgin's Mantle. It's called Phegonia cretacea, and I used to boil that with lemons and drink that twice a day. And that's a traditional herbal remedy in Afghanistan and Pakistan, where some of my family come from, for breast cancer. So I tried to actually tune into things that are part of a tradition in my own genealogy, if you know what I mean. Mm. Tasted quite unpleasant. I also took turkey tail mushroom because I know that there's a huge link between Epstein-Barr virus and breast cancer, and that basically turkey tail mushroom is very good for that aspect of healing. I took echinacea and astragalus daily. And I actually spoke to a friend of mine who's a herbalist to actually look at me, because I couldn't look at myself properly. I was very good with symptomatic relief, but actually looking at myself. Like I said, I wasn't a very good patient, but I also changed my whole life. I started doing a modified Gerson therapy, and I drank lots of juices. I started doing coffee enemas, which are actually a herbal remedy because it's the phytochemicals in the coffee that affect your liver making more glutathione. I also took up doing Tai Chi and Qigong every day. And I gave up my addictions, like drinking tea and coffee, sitting in the afternoon and eating a croissant and drinking a coffee. I changed my whole lifestyle. And, you know, some of my friends that see me now compared to how I was in the past, even though I thought I was generally quite healthy, I've changed so much about my lifestyle since a cancer diagnosis. Mm. I mean, everything I put in my body, I think, would I give this to a baby? Would I give this to a toddler? Is it safe? So I'm very, I eat foods and I act like, what would I give that food? You know, I love my own body. So that's a change that I've made. So to say how herbs have affected me alone are very difficult, because I changed everything so dramatically, so quickly and so consistently till today.
Mm. Okay, well, thanks for that. Yes, and thanks generally for speaking to us today. We're going to have to finish now, but I'm pretty sure that what you've been saying there will inspire many more people with cancer to consider using herbal medicine, at least at some stage of their journey. So thanks very much for your expertise today. It's been brilliant.
You're welcome. You're welcome.
Claudia certainly put the case there for herbs and dietary measures as an important part of an integrative cancer treatment protocol. The initiative that I mentioned of Starting the Conversation will be the theme of this year's Yes to Life annual London conference in the autumn, so watch this space for more details. If you're a runner, or if you'd like to be a runner, or if you know any runners, the first Yes to Life 10K race is in Victoria Park, East London, on Sunday the 24th of September. It's got its own website, yestolife10k.org. That's yestolife10k.org. So do take a look. I hope you can listen again next week, when I'll be looking into the matter of hydration with an expert on the subject, Paul Barattiero. Goodbye.